Every year, students across the region take standardized tests, math, science, reading, and every year when the results come out, there's a bit of hand-wringing in the media. We saw it last month when the CMEC, or Council of Ministers of Education, released its latest research. Why are the math scores down in one province? Why are girls doing better at reading and seemingly worse at science than boys? Then the governments announce some reviews, there are media articles about getting back to basics, and we wait until next year's results come out. Meanwhile, many educators and administrators quietly work away trying to figure out something called the achievement gap. Why some students flourish while others barely scrape by, fail classes, or drop out of school altogether. I'm Pauline Dakin, and this is Atlantic Voice. And today, Leslie Lowe shows us how, in many cases, it's what happens before a kid gets to school that determines his or her future. This is Leslie's documentary, Mind the Gap.
How are you feeling about the first day of school?
Excited.
Tell me how the first day of school makes you feel.
Excited, and because I want to learn.
And do you ever get nervous about how you'll do, or are you just excited to get at it?
I get a little bit nervous because of my dad.
Okay, what's today?
The first day of school.
And how are you feeling about it?
Really excited.
Really? Are you going to do well?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
We'll try.
The hardest.
Yeah.
And will it be difficult or easy?
I'm not sure.
Medium.
Thanks, guys. Samantha, how are you feeling about the first day of school?
Great.
Are you excited?
Yes, I'm very excited about the first day of school.
Do you think you're going to do well?
Yes, I think I'm going to do very well, but I'm not really sure. Especially for when it's time to read. I don't think I'll do that good. Well, I don't even know if we're going to be reading because it's the first day of school.
Some of these kids will follow through on those ecstatic first day of school hopes. Some of them just aren't going to make it. So what determines which of those voices ends up on the right side of the report card and which end up on the wrong side? You won't be surprised if I say money is part of it. It's a fact. Richer kids make higher grades straight across the country, and they're more likely to attend university too. Meanwhile, among the poorest 25% of children, fewer than 3 out of 10 make it to Frosh Week. But it's not just poorer students. Students who are physically or psychologically disabled, African-Canadian students, and First Nations youth are also less likely to end up in post-secondary institutions.
We're at the big girl end now.
There's a tidy term for this phenomenon, the achievement gap. And the achievement gap isn't black and white. Because how well students do isn't determined by the color of their skin, or whether they're in a wheelchair, or if they live in subsidized housing. The achievement gap, in some ways, is about how kids have been prepared for this day.
Hi, I'm Alice Moriarty.
Can you tell Alice Moriarty teaches elementary school? She's got that caring, exuberant voice, that ability to make you feel like the star pupil. Even here, one-on-one, in her Clayton Park living room over cheese and crackers and the achievement gap. Oh, Alice knows the achievement gap. Even before she knew what to call it, she knew what it was. She's been a teacher for 30 years, and she's devoted most of that time to Halifax's neediest neighborhoods.
Need would be greater largely because of finances and in some cases because of physical location and things that aren't provided readily in some environments. But they would also be, not all, but many, many children who lacked good nutrition, who lacked good sleep patterns, who didn't feel safe at home or in the environment outside of the school, and who absolutely didn't get the attention and support they needed and deserved, not always through the fault of their parents, but because of the circumstance.
Alice grew up on working-class Brunswick Street in Halifax's North End. Eight kids in one house with plenty of encouragement, high expectations, and lots of trips to the library. But each year in her classrooms, she experiences something different.
Many of our children would never have been to the library, would never have had anybody to read them a good night story. And when I checked about books available in the home, most of the time the answer, I sent out a little questionnaire early in the year, and most of the answers when it said how many books, children's books, would you have in your home, the answer almost always came back zero.
For some kids it's normal. They've always been read to. Other children, as Alice points out, have never had an adult in their homes read them a story before bedtime. They can arrive that first day of school without knowing whether a book in their hands is right side up or upside down. But the achievement gap isn't as simple as bedtime stories.
I would say that after the children leave me, there are about 19 hours left in the day. And we have to think about who's responsible then and how I can engage that person in committing to their child's education, because it just doesn't happen only in that 5 hours. 5 hours is really just the introduction. It's the springboard to the rest of it.
We are not coming to school as, you know, as a blank sheet. You know, we have already collected a certain amount of experiences. We have been shaped by, you know, the environment we have been growing up in.
All right.
Yeah. Well, my name is Cornelia Schneider. Okay. I am an assistant professor here at Mount St. Vincent University. Okay, do you want me just to hold it here, maybe?
No, I'll hold it.
Is that
it.
Okay?
Yeah. It's
okay.
Really sensitive, so that's really actually bad.
Cornelia teaches teachers. Well, she teaches students who want to be teachers. She's originally from Germany, but she came to Halifax 4 years ago at 32.
I'm coming from a family my mother was an elementary school teacher, my father was a lawyer.
I've come to the Mount to ask her about the achievement gap, and she explains it using a story from her own life.
I already knew at age 3, 2, 3, 4, 5 what school was about. Because I got access to schools, my mom would take me to schools. There were certain attitudes, certain behaviors that were, of course, supported and encouraged. You know, use pen, paper and pencil, do certain activities that prepare you for school. So when I enrolled into school in grade one, I was already totally prepared.
So far, so good. Little Cornelia starts grade school. And she's in school with a whole group of other excited grade school first-timers. And one of them is a little boy named Jacob.
My other little friend, Jacob, who I went to kindergarten with, he had parents that worked in a factory that maybe, you know, stopped with school at age 15 or 16, that didn't have a positive schooling experience. And, you know, naturally, if you look at this story, who is already in advance compared to, you know, what school knowledge and curriculum is expecting from children, I was, of course. So this is really social production at its finest to a certain extent. That doesn't mean that there are not children who can, you know, overcome that. And luckily there are. I mean, we have social mobility in any industrialized country. But at the same time, there are certain things that make it very difficult for those kids to catch up. And as I said, some, you know, the inequality is already there in grade one, actually. And it's up to the teachers, basically, to work with that. But social class is something, for example, in North America that people don't talk a lot about.
A decade ago, American sociologist Annette Leroux got together a research team and looked at how the home lives of children affect their achievement. Leroux did this kind of fly-on-the-wall recording of the mundane, day-to-day events in the lives of a group of kids. Basketball games, driving to doctor's appointments, Sunday dinners, parent-teacher interviews, anything. Everything. Leroux found the parents basically fall into one of two categories: natural growth or concerted cultivation. In natural growth, children pretty much manage their own development. They're disciplined by their parents, they're well-loved, but they're by and large left to organize themselves, calling their own friends to come and play, juggling their own homework deadlines. That's natural growth. And those parents, Leroux found, are usually working class or poor. Now, in concerted cultivation, the parents are mostly middle or upper income and typically highly educated. They navigate their kids' development and foster their children's interests. So, for example, if little Kaylee likes watching the U.S. Open, her mom might buy her a can of balls and a racket, sign her up for tennis lessons. If Kaylee's not so jazzed about learning her times tables, her dad'll do extra math sessions with her after supper. Speaking of school, children of concerted cultivators know their letters, know their colors, know their shapes. They can count up to at least 20, and that's all before they hear their first morning bell.
Supportive parents, always there. The kinds of, the reading, the traveling they did with their children, that's a financial thing. The things the children had experienced, the vision they could bring to classroom discussions because they'd been here, there, and everywhere. The environmental print that they had in place when they walked in the door because they had seen a much bigger picture of the environment. The stuff they had in place, I mean, they all had letter recognition, sound symbol association, ability to print their own name, recognized classmates' names in about 2 days. Lots and lots and lots of stuff in place.
So, concerted cultivation's a no-brainer, right? Now, here's where things get really interesting. The children of working class and poor parents, Leroux's natural growth parents, of course their kids gain skills too. Those children, Leroux found, they rarely whine. They rarely complain they're bored. Sure, they have a lot of free time, more free time than the tennis and ballet and choir and violin book kids of cultivators, but they fill it. They show more independence. They often show more creativity. They don't need adults to solve squabbles over who gets the last cookie. Natural growth language is direct, clear, short. There are fewer negotiations, and Leroux found less talking back. So ultimately, concerted cultivation, natural growth, no one approach is better. They're just different ways of raising kids. Until it comes to school.
Historically, school has been set up for a certain group of people. Before it became mandatory schooling during industrialization, we had schools that were for children out of aristocracy or higher middle class. School is set up in a way, you know, we have the ranks, everybody's sitting in ranks. There's one teacher in the front, everybody looks at that teacher. That teacher is this idea of transmitting knowledge and all these things. So again, it comes back to school system that has been created for a certain group of people, and then it has become mandatory for everyone, but by not acknowledging that everyone is not the same as this group of people that originally was created for.
I almost don't want to say it out loud, but school was created for white, wealthy children, boys. It was designed to work for them, from the way classrooms were organized to what was taught and how. Who schools teach has changed dramatically in the intervening centuries, but the fundamental structure, what's valued, what's measured, the definitions of success, and the definitions of failure haven't kept stride. Kids are expected to adapt to the system, not the other way around. But how does a kid change her racial identity, stop being poor, leave behind a disability? It's impossible. And sometimes, it's just the kids who are a little bit different. Picture a child, a grade 2 boy. He's happy, strapping, he's curious, and he needs to move around a lot. He's kinetic. It's like it's in his DNA. Kids in classrooms don't stroll around when they're listening to stories or working through mental math problems. Kids in classrooms sit. The desks might be in a semicircle instead of rows. Mats on the floor might stand in for chairs sometimes. But kids learn to sit. They sit to learn. That's how school is. Thinking on his feet may be literally what that boy needs to do. And there's some flexibility in the system for that. But chances are that child is going to have to learn to sit still, just like everyone else. So why do schools ask kids to change? Why can't schools change?
For whatever reason, we are afraid of having a system that delivers different things to different people, because all of a sudden, well, it's kind of like the conversation about healthcare, right? If you want to stop a conversation about healthcare reform, what do you say? You say, that's going to lead to two-tier healthcare. All over. Now you have to move along. Oh, now we can't talk about that. And it's the same thing with education. Charles Sortwell, I'm the president of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies. It makes absolutely no sense, because we know that in education, every kid's different. Every classroom is different. Every group of kids is different. Every teacher is different. The relationship between the teacher and the student is going to be different. We need to design a system that allows that to happen. So far, we haven't got there, at least in Atlantic Canada. We have elsewhere in the world. If you look in Sweden, if you look more broadly in Alberta and British Columbia, you have systems that say, you know what? We spent a lot of money training principals, training teachers. Maybe we should give them some authority to run their classrooms. What a shocking concept.
Charles Sortwell doesn't mince words. Can you tell?
They're abysmal.
He invited me into the boardroom of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, where there's an expansive 13th floor view of Citadel Hill, and just off to the right, the Department of Education HQ. He's looking over their shoulders, he jokes. Charles is a policy analyst, a suit and tie guy, with a politician's flair for sound bites. One of Charles's big arguments when it comes to the achievement gap is that school boards try way too hard to level the playing field.
We have what I call the uniquely Canadian concept that universality requires that everybody gets the same thing. And the simple reality there is not everybody needs the same thing. And so we get into this idea that if we start to differentiate, someone's going to get more than the other person. And I guess I look at it and I say, government has a remarkable potential to structure what we do to rebalance other things in society that are out of balance. And instead of doing that, we simply insist that if you have an advantage, we're going to take it away. Instead of saying, well, you have an advantage, so we're going to try and find a way to give that to other people because clearly it's helped you. No, no. Our approach is to say, no, anybody who has an advantage, we must strip that away.
Equal recognition, that's fine. You know, for me, that's maybe where I would say, okay, that, you know, give equal recognition to certain groups or certain or the children in the classroom, but that doesn't mean in my actions I will treat them equally, because it will not live up to where they come from. In terms of, you know, the working class kid that has never seen a school building from the inside, if I go look into grade one, you know. The African Nova Scotian child who is maybe the only one in that classroom, the child in a wheelchair that needs someone to go to the bathroom with, you know, these things are real, and we cannot just pretend they don't exist. They are part of the conversation, so we might as well talk about them.
If everybody came through the door of our school system at the same level, then equality would be good enough. But when that doesn't happen, we need to look at the kinds of things we can do to give everybody a fair and reasonable chance, understanding that there will always be people who can't get it for a variety of reasons, but always our challenge is to try and reach all of them, no matter what the circumstance. And some things are just obvious. We have areas of this city where children start out with less, academically and financially and socially, and we can do something about the academics if we're committed to it.
We're absolutely terrified about admitting that, you know what, there are kids in Preston who we have failed, not only in this generation, but their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation. We're absolutely terrified to talk about Whitney Pier. We're absolutely terrified to talk about what's going on at Creighton Street. And you know what? We have to. And we have to step up and say, we can do this better. We have had these kind of systemic problems in this province for a long time. Generally, the conversations have been ugly. They've been finger-pointing. They tend to be divisive. And it's uncomfortable. But if we don't come at it straight ahead, if we don't honestly say to people, you know what? Yes, we have lots of things that we're doing well, but here are the things that we're doing badly. And that's the other thing. You point out something that's going wrong in this province and you're just labeled as a critic, a downer, you just get out of here, you know, we don't want to have that conversation. You don't make things better if you don't identify what's going wrong.
And that's Sylvia Paris's job.
Hi. Sylvia, hey.
Nice to meet you as well.
Thanks so much for making
it. I grew up in a little community in Guysborough County, Mulgrave. My name is Sylvia Paris, and here at the Department of Education, I'm the Multicultural Education Consultant. for us, we know that as a system, we have done not so great a job in terms of responding to the needs of all the populations, of all the communities that exist.
Sylvia Paris started out as a teacher in 1980. She later moved to policy work with the Nova Scotia Department of Education. In a labyrinthine office just down the street, in fact, from Alice Moriarty's childhood home, and with Charles Sirtwell looking over her shoulder, Sylvia works on the big picture, boosting opportunities for the province's neediest kids. She specializes in the challenges facing African Nova Scotian learners. And that's a clue to why Sylvia is in charge of the Achievement Gap file. Because in Nova Scotia, you can't talk about the Achievement Gap without talking about race. The province's failures in connecting with African Nova Scotian learners was the subject of a landmark study in 1994 called the Black Learners Advisory Committee Report. You can practically think of the Black Report as the history of the Achievement Gap in Nova Scotia. The Black Report was updated in 2009. One of the key recommendations was that the province start doing a better job of keeping track of achievement. So last November, Sylvia Paris oversaw the surveying of 24,000 students in grades 3 to 12 to see how well their needs were being met. The students were also given the chance to self-identify by race. And now the work's begun. And that mostly means educating teachers to become culturally proficient, to use the language of the day.
It is the professional development. It is the resources. It is like an ability to look at policies and say, how is that disenfranchising a group of people? You have to have an expectation and support that expectation that says everyone has the potential for excellence, and it's my role to help bring that out. And what do I need to do that? My role individually, my role as a system, my role as a policy implementer. Like, what do I need to do that? That's why cultural proficiency keeps saying, so what's my role? What do I have to do? It doesn't say to the other person. It doesn't other things at all. It says, what do I need to do? And I keep continuing to do that. I mean, sometimes in our in PD work, you say, how long do you work with a student until, you know, to help them reach their success? So the answer is easy, until they reach their success.
Another way of saying it, we practice equity to get to equality.
And sometimes when I've done some work with folks around policy, and trying to talk about racial equity policy or equity policies broadly, you know, you use kind of the demonstration with a glass of water, right? So you've got a glass of water that says 2/3 full, and you've got a glass of water that is, say, half full. If I give you, in terms of filling those to the top, if I give you exactly the same amount of water to use, one is going to run over. I give you enough, right? One is going to run over because you have more than you need, and the other one may not reach the top. So what you would do kind of naturally is look at that, and you take 1/3 and fill that one up to the top, because my request was that you fill them to the top, and the other one you put half in so that it comes all the way to the top. So it's really like that. What is it that you need? And now those glasses are equal, right? So equity practices are about fairness and about coming to a way, utilizes resources in the most effective manner so that equality is reached.
Except the first Black Report came out in 1994. And even as far back as 1841, the report notes, Black residents of Halifax were petitioning for a training school for African Nova Scotian teachers. Cornelia Schneider says the Achievement Gap, though it didn't have a name until recently, has been dogging us since industrialization. How can this be taking so long to write?
Because that's what we know. That's what we know, you know, and taking risks and going away from that model is for everyone very, very complicated. And, you know, a lot of folks, not all of them, but a lot of folks that are becoming teachers because they have a positive history with school. So for them, actually, that model has been, you know, positive. They were high achievers. They made it to university. They got their degrees. They got their BEDs. They got whatever other degree. So for them, it's, you know, they don't have the issue with that system. But all the others that, left school early, dropped out, failed courses and so on and so on. Most of them are not going into the teaching profession.
That's the challenge, right, is to recognize that every dollar that we don't spend correctly in education is 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 or $100 that we're going to spend on cops and judges and doctors.
Thanks, Charles.
That was depressing. We can do this better. That's my problem. We all know how to do this, and we're just too stubborn not to.
But that doesn't mean we won't keep trying.
Teachers need to be trusted to understand that learning can come in different ways, that success can look different in different situations, and to support the success they find and allow it to grow.
We're going to do it. For us, it's a matter of how long it's going to take us to get it done, what bumps you might hit along the way trying to do it right. It's just a given, right? We are going to make this happen.
I'm Leslie Lowe in Halifax.
Have a good day, guys.
Leslie's story first aired on our show back in 2011. Now, we've had lots of requests from people looking for copies of this piece, so we're putting it back up on our website, and you can go to cbc.ca/Atlantic Voice to hear that. Now, in Leslie's story, we heard about a style of parenting called concerted cultivation. Well, next week, we'll bring you a new documentary from the CBC's Vanessa Blanche. She's been looking into the increasing number of private schools that have been opening in the region and the increasing numbers of middle-income parents making a financial sacrifice to send their kids to those schools. She'll tell us why it may have less to do with the state of public education and more to do with this parenting philosophy. Well, that's next week on Atlantic Voice. I'm Pauline Dakin for Christina Harnett and me. Thanks for listening and have a great week.